Greeks and an archaeologist conducted a fireside on the relationship between the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Mormon Church.
Now this will give us an idea of the Dead Sea area. Here's the Dead Sea, and that picture you saw just previously is over here in these hills. And about this point is the great area of Masada. And just 7 miles south of Jericho, here's Jericho, right here on the northern part of the Dead Sea, in 1945, Muhammad Adib, a member of the Tamira tribe who had occupied this territory for 300 years, he and his cousin and uncle were smuggling contraband from the Jordan side into the Israeli side. They were trying to find caves in which to put the contraband. They threw stones in a particular cave and they heard the breaking of ceramic ware. They lowered themselves into the caves, and here they found a number of jars. They removed the tops of the jars, and inside the jars, which were 2.5 feet to 3 feet high, they found bundles in foul-smelling bituminous material. When they broke off this bituminous material inside, wrapped in beautiful linen materials, were scrolls, some of them 23, 27 feet long and 18 inches wide. They took 4 of these scrolls to Bethlehem, and there they hung in gunny sacks for about 2 years. Bethlehem is the area where the Tamir tribe has their main headquarters. In fact, on the southern hills of Bethlehem, you can see a city built by the Tamir tribe from the monies they received from the scrolls. These 4 scrolls, then, in the possession of Muhammad Adib and his family, were finally taken into Bethlehem in 1947 and early 48 and offered for sale to an antiquities dealer. The antiquities dealer told him that he wasn't interested in the leather scrolls, but a bootmaker next door by the name of Kondo might be. Kondo bought the 4 scrolls. Now, the story and material published in the literature is quite different than the story revealed by the man himself. Kondo became rather an enigmatic figure, a mysterious individual. He became the link between the Tamir tribe and the Department of Antiquities because it's a very delicate thing. The Antiquities Department controls these kind of things, and it's against the law to go in and pilfer caves and things of that kind. But since the Tamir tribe know this area so immensely, they had to have a contact representing themselves with the academic world. Kondo became that man, not intentionally, but he took the first 4 scrolls. They say he paid $5 for them. Later on, he was to reveal other information. He told the boys he'd give them 2/3 of whatever he got. Well, Kondo took the 4 scrolls, and later on, in 48, he took them to his bishop, who was the bishop of the oldest Syrian church, Christian church in the world, Athanasius Samuel. And Athanasius Samuel was a very educated man, and when he heard they'd come from the north part of the Dead Sea, he remembered the story of Tichendorf, and he remembered that no one had lived in the northern part of the Dead Sea for 1,900 years. And therefore, if those scrolls had come from that area, it was possible they might be 2,000 years old. So immediately he purchased the scrolls from Kondo. He knew about the Book of Sinai and the value that the Tsar of Russia had put on it, and the Russians and communists when they had sold to the British Museum. So he purchased the scrolls for $250 American. Athanasius Samuel then tried to find an expert to tell him how antique or old the scrolls were. He couldn't find anyone who dared pronounce the antiquity of the scrolls. One man, a man named Dr. Reichler, said of the scrolls were as old as that he said they were or thought they were, the table upon which they were sitting. If it was a box filled with $5 notes, that would be the value of the scrolls. He didn't miss it very far. And now the year is 1948, it's November. And in the month of October, November, Samuel learns that there's a couple of young men at the American School of Oriental Research on the outside the old city of Jerusalem in the new city area. And he contacts the department there and finds that the manager or the head of the department is in Baghdad. But a young photographer and scholar and New Testament archaeologist, Dr. Trevor, happens to be there. Dr. Trevor was probably one of 10 men at the time who could have made an on-the-spot examination and possible pronouncement as to age. And he got permission to photograph these first scrolls that Samuel had. Samuel sent them by priests, one of his priests, through the entanglement that was occurring about this time. And Dr. Trevor photographed one of the scrolls, sent the photograph to Dr. Albright, the head of all the great and the dean of the archaeologist of Palestine, and Dr. Albright cabled back, "Get the scrolls out of Jerusalem. I prefer a date of 100 B.C., and there's not the slightest doubt about their antiquity." So they tried to get the scrolls out and smuggle them out, because what happened in November was the United Nations announced the Republic of Judea or Palestine or Israel for the first time in nearly 1,900 years, and the Arabs and the Israelis immediately went to war. There was a 6-month war, and by May, the Republic had been established. In the meantime, one of the antiquity buyers there in Bethlehem had got the boys of the Jamir tribe to take him back out to the caves. And he got three more scrolls, and he brought them into Bethlehem and let the word be known through his contacts to the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And there was a man by the name of Dr. Sukinik. Dr. Sukinik's son was the first Jewish general in 1900 years. Dr. Kinik's son, Yagil Yadin, was the chief of staff and the head of the Haganah, and the one who wrote the military manual for the Jewish people, and of course was the one who helped establish the military victory to establish them as a republic in May of 1949. But Dr. Sukinik was an archaeologist, and when he smuggled himself through the barbed wire and got a hold of the scrolls, he brought them back the very night the United Nations declared Israel a republic. And he tried to tell people that he had just seen these scrolls and that they were fantastic, and they went back into the centuries before Christ, but the news of the nation of Israel being established was so great that hardly anyone even thought about what he had learned. But he purchased these three scrolls. There are now seven scrolls that come from the first cave that have been discovered by the Tamir tribe. In the meantime, Samuel, the priest carrying the scrolls from the American School of Research, had been killed by shellfire right at the gate of the American schools. Samuel's monastery was being demolished by shellfire, so he finally got the scrolls smuggled out and came to New York. And then after the six-month war was ended, in May, Yagidjadin, through a friend of his in New York, was able to purchase those four scrolls from Samuel for $250,000. And then Dr. Gottesman, who put up the money for the scrolls, gave them as a gift to Israel. Israel then built a museum in the shape of the lid of one of the jars. This is the area where the caves were found, because now the world began to realize momentous discoveries had been found. The Tamir tribe began to bring in more scroll material, until finally there was a flood of documents and fragments coming in through Kondo, the antiquities dealer in Bethlehem. In fact, the value of the scrolls was so immense that the Tamir tribe were being paid $5 for a piece the size of your little fingernail. And this is the areas of the Wadi of Qumran. Here you can see some people walking along the wadi down at the bottom here to give you an idea of the immensity of the country and its wilderness. Eventually, the tribe brought in a whole series of documents. So the Jordan Legion, who was in control of this area at the time, put up a military blockade for the Tamir tribe in this area, and they put teams of archaeologists into the vicinity. This is the first cave that the Tamir tribe boys and Muhammad Adib had got into. In this cave, they found evidences that there had been 90 jars. A fantastic library, but we only have seven scrolls. So 90% of the library at least is missing. We don't know where it is or who got it. There was a possibility that a man by the name of Shapiro found this cave in 1883 and took four beautiful documents to London. And there he offered them for sale and also represented them as being 2,000 years old, but there was no one of sufficient scientific knowledge in 1883 to really establish the proof of those scrolls, because they were on white gazelle skin, perfectly preserved. And when they called him a forger, and the books he brought with him forgeries, he knew they were totally authentic. He went to France and committed suicide, and the four scrolls have disappeared, and they've never been found. A whole book has been written on his life now, just recently, because they feel he got into the cave first and removed some of the scrolls. And this is one of the jars. And in a moment, you can see the top of the jar. You'll see a building that's built in that shape. They're about 2.5 feet high, and they could carry as many as 2 to 4 scrolls. And this is a view from cave number 4. It's when the Department of Antiquities and the Legion established themselves in the area. They found 280 caves. They found every book of the Old Testament except the Book of Esther. They found 330 books that we had never known about before. In this cave, they found 10,000 identifiable documents. It has taken 20 years now to translate and edit the contents of the first four caves. 11 major caves were found, and if you were to read at the rate of one publication a week, it will now take you 21 years to read all that has been written on the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I think a lot of you got a little bit of work to do. In the background is the Dead Sea, and this green orchard down here is a spring, the freshwater spring of En-Gedi. Here are the cliffs that the caves, four of the caves were found in. The background is the Dead Sea. You notice over here, these are ruins. In 1952, when they were doing work around the caves, they found these ruins were associated with the caves, and they excavated these ruins. And then they found that these caves and the materials apparently had been written by people who lived in these ruins. Next. Here's an aerial view of the ruins of Qumran. As they excavated and read the scrolls, they were able to deduce the most fascinating story. And I'll tell you about that in a few moments. But over the ruins, you see that there were circular pits where the waters were collected. There were a number of baptismal founts. When I was in Israel in April, the former mission president of Finland, Paulson, was with us, and he and his wife stepped down into the baptismal font, and there were places on both sides for witness to stand. And there we took pictures of them in the baptismal font of the community. The baptismal font was one of the lowest places in the community. It had a two-story structure. They had a reservoir coming in from on the upper part. You see a wall, and they brought water in from the wadis or the gullies when the rains would occur. Over 5,000 people lived here 200 years before the time of Christ. And in the year 35 BC, they were instructed by revelation to take their scrolls, wrap them in linen, soak them in linseed oil, wrap them in bituminous material, and put them in jars and hide them away, not to be available to their until their predestined time. Next. Here again, the caves, the ruins sitting on the cliffs where the caves are. You can see that circular one that was on the previous picture. Next. This is a view of several of the caves from the ruins. You can actually see these by standing on the ruins. Next. This is the great meeting hall of the ruins. Here the priests would all gather, and I'll read to you from one of their actual scrolls what they would do there in a few moments. Next. This is one of the cisterns, all plastered up quite nicely, so that it would hold water for their rituals and ordinations. Next. This is the scriptorium. These long tables were found in the upper room, and they're about 30 feet long. Here they would unroll their scrolls, or here's where they'd take these skins and sew them together and prepare them right upon them. And at the end of the table, there's a basin. And whenever they came to the sacred name of God, they would wash their hands and then return and write the sacred name of God on the scrolls. Next. This is one of the 330 books that we had never known about before, one of the most fascinating ones, and one which I'll read to you from. It's called the Seric Scroll, or the Manual of Discipline. Its contents indicate that the restoration of the Church of Jesus Christ is now completely validated and proven in terms of doctrinal content by virtue of this over 2,100-year-old scroll. Next. Here you can see in the city of Jerusalem this building in the shape of the jar. This is near the Great Museum, and what you're looking at is part of the Hebrew University. And this is where the scrolls now are all placed for viewing and study. Next. This is the building close up. I've had some interesting experiences in this building, and I'll tell you about one as we go along. There's also a very important scroll we'll tell you about that was found in 1962 that has a special place in this museum. Next. This is one of the scrolls that tells about some of the historical background of these people, who knew more about the things to come in the last days than even the prophets. And we'll read to you where he got the information. Next. Put this in focus, because this was the photograph that Dr. Trevor sent to John Hopkins University. This is a photograph of an ancient book of Isaiah that goes back 200 BC. Next. This is the Dome of the Rock on the sacred site of the ancient Temple of Solomon, and where the second temple was built by Nehemiah and Ezra. Also the place where Abraham was to have offered sacrifice of Isaac. It's the second most sacred shrine of all of the Islam world, the Mohammedans. It's the Mosque of Omar. It has to be destroyed in order for the third temple to be built. Next. This is my son who took that previous picture when he was in Israel several years ago, standing on the site of the New Jerusalem Temple, where the temple was dedicated to be built in the latter days. Now, there's some significance to these photographs you'll learn about shortly. Next. This is another part of where the temple site will be in Jackson County, Missouri. Next. Now we're back to the Mosque of Omar. And there's great relatedness in these particular pictures, and you'll remember them when I come to the description of a scroll found in 1967. Next. In the background is the Mount of Olives, and the Dome of the Rock, or that beautiful Mosque of Omar, is right behind me. In fact, my son took this picture, and I visited the same area myself, of course, and knew where he took it. But on that mountain in the background, in 1841, a man by the name of Orson Hyde dedicated the land for the return of the Jews. Orson Hyde had been converted in 1830, and Joseph Smith had confirmed him. And when he confirmed him, he told Orson that, "Orson, the Lord has selected you, because he was a Jew, to dedicate the land for the return of the Jews. Well, it startled him. Orson Hyde, if he'd lived a few years longer, would have been the president of the church. He was the president of the Quorum of Twelve just before he died. Orson Hyde then contemplated this for many years. 10 years later, he received a six-hour vision of how he would go and where he would do and what he would do and say at the Mount of Olives. A couple of months later, he was called at the conference of the church to go to Israel and dedicated for the land of return of the Jews. A year and a half later, he arrived at the Mount of Olives, accomplishing all that his vision had indicated to him. And there on October the 21st, and Sunday morning, he built a little altar and issued and gave his prayer. He wrote it down while he said it there on the Mount of Olives. And this is very important because it comes to something that's most startling in the last year. And then he returned home. There on the Mount of Olives, he dedicated the land for the return of Jews. The population of Palestine was 8,000 Jews at that time. Next. Now, from the Mount of Olives, we're looking back again. We're looking right from the spot where Orson Hyde gave his prayer. The Garden of Gethsemane is down here. And then you see the wall of the city, the old city of Jerusalem. Now, we're going to look to the left on the next picture. Next. Here you see the wall coming across, again the Garden of Gethsemane, and you see this gate over here. That's the gate that Christ is supposed to walk through, or the Messiah, when he comes. It's a cemetery now, because no Jewish rabbi or any master in the Jewish religion is ever supposed to go through a cemetery. So people have deliberately buried their bodies there in order to prohibit the Messiah from coming, and then they've blocked off that gate called the Stephen Gate. But you can imagine how Christ is going to handle that situation. It's resurrected. Clear it up. Next. Now again, we're back to the Dome of the Rock, or the Mosque of Omar. Here in early on a morning, my son took this picture. He had very special experiences. Normally, they come and talk with me. I have two sons, but both of them are quite busy at the moment in their schooling. Next. I think that was the last one. Turn the lights back on. This is a replica of one of the jars that was obtained in Israel. And this is a replica, 1/4 size, of one of the scrolls, the Sirach scroll. This is what it looked like in color and texture and everything, except just imagine it 4 times larger. After the excavations had all taken place and translations began to appear, then the world was started by the contents of the documents and by the history of the community that was revealed. In 200 years, in the year about 200 years before Christ, members of the family of Zadok. Now, Zadok was a priest, a high priest, holding the Melchizedek priesthood that had been given it by Jesus Christ himself, according to Joseph Smith, in the time of David. And his descendants had occupied the authority and in matters of the temple. The Aaronic priesthood officiated in the ordinances, but the high priests were the family of Zadok. In the year 200 BC, the family of Zadok was kicked out of the temple, depossessed, and false priests who usurped the priesthood. The Sadducees and the Pharisee parties had now been established in Judah. And they went into the wilderness, these true priests, and there they set up their community. They built this community and developed the freshwater spring. And there they stayed for 20 years praying. Then at the end of 20 years, a man by the name of Asaph received revelation. His father was named Asaph, and it's a very important relationship. And Dr. Vermeij, one of the leading Catholic scholars on the Dead Sea Scrolls, says his teaching consisted mainly of the interpretation of the Word of God and most of all of the writings of the prophet. The understanding of mysteries was, according to the Habakkuk commentary, one of the pictures you saw on the slides, revealed to him not by an angel, as was the case with Daniel, but directly by God. He had a better knowledge than even the prophets of events concerning the end of time. And in several of the scrolls, we find the actual autograph of Asaph describing his first vision. You could insert it into the testimony of Joseph Smith, and it would be paralleled. He says, O God, I give thanks unto thee, for thou didst appear unto me face to face. And then he received instructions. The whole thing was this. He was to have restored to him what had been had 5 times before in preparation of the coming of the Messiah. And then he was instructed in this vein. In the council of the community there shall be 12, and 3 priests who are perfect in the law have been revealed of the whole law, true witnesses. Then an additional, a most holy abode belongs to Aaron with eternal knowledge to enact laws and to offer up an agreeable odor in the house of perfection to establish a covenant with eternal ordinances. And only the sons of Aaron shall have authority in matters of law and property. They would be the ones who would be recipients of the tithing, interview for baptism, and they baptized between the age of 8 and 9. The sons of Aaron were those who had this office.
Dr. Albright, in working over that portion of the scrolls, was to write in his own book these passages. The organization of the earliest Christians, as sketched in Acts, is reminiscent of the practice at Qumran 200 years before Christ was born. For example, at Qumran, they were ruled by a special body of 12 men and 3 priests. Apostolic Christianity abolished the old Jewish priesthood, but the principle of rule by 12 men, the apostles, continued. And so you see, people think, aha, Christ didn't originate anything. And that's when a series of books have been published, trying to show that all Christ did was actually perhaps learn from this community these doctrines. And it goes on, the term multitude for the assemblage of believers at Qumran, firmly established in the Qumran literature, is found repeatedly in Acts in the exact same translation for the assembly of Christians as a whole. Can you guess what that word might be? Any of you? What do you think it might be? Saints. That's right. And what do we call ourselves today? Latter-day Saints. If we were to translate our name back into the original ancient archaic Hebrew that was found in these documents, the only difference between the name of that community and the church at the time of Acts and us would be our name would be prefixed by Latter-day. More striking, if possible, Dr. Albright says, is the fact that the term for overseer, inspector, and superintendent, the office of the sons of Aaron, is literally translated in the New Testament as bishop. Then Unibley points out in one of his translations and also one of the other translations by DuPont Somner, they had presiding bishops. Only a son of Aaron could be a bishop. And that is a peculiar doctrine of the LDS Church and has been since 1830, when Joseph Smith informed us that if you were a tribe of Levi, descendant of Aaron, you'd be entitled, if righteous, to be called up to be a bishop without counselors. The office peculiar to the office of sons of Aaron. Dr. Gaster, this is the text I use when I teach the class. In an institute class, it takes a whole semester to give you a summary. I'm trying to give you a summary of a summary tonight. So if I speak fast and move along, that's because there's so much material to cover. Dr. Gaster says, but still, this is not a forerunner of Christianity, this community. He says, there are essential doctrines missing in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There is, for instance, no vestige of the idea of original sin in the Dead Sea Scrolls. On the contrary, the idea is affirmed constantly in the Book of Hymns, which is a Dead Sea Scroll, that every man is endowed at birth with a charisma or inheritance of knowledge and discernment. And then in sinfulness he incurs is due to his individual neglect. And sin is individual, not the inherited lot of man. It's incurred by his personal disposition and can be removed also by his own individual experience and repentance. He says, since there's no concept of universal sin or original sin, there's obviously no place for universal vicarious atonement. And also, he says, men suffer their individual crucifixion and resurrection. He goes on to say such things as this. I'm going to bring you another document, read it to you in a moment. But he says, for argument's sake, this, if the document does refer to a certain sacrament, it's not the sacrament in the Christian sense. Because in the Dead Sea Scroll, when the priests met in that long room I was telling you about, here's what they did. When they arranged the table to eat or the wine to drink, the priest shall first stretch out his hand to invoke a blessing with the first of the bread. Or the wine to drink. If I were to ask you, when was the order of sacrament first given, and bread and wine, I think every one of you would say, well, Thursday night, before Christ was resurrected and crucified, before he was crucified on that Friday afternoon. And yet, some of you might have in your library the book called Gospel Through the Ages. It was a priesthood manual. Joseph Smith, in the inspired version, points out this. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine. He brake bread and blessed it. He blessed the wine. He being the priest of the Most High God, and he gave to Abraham. The doctrine of sacrament, as Milner Hunter points out here, had been had in previous dispensations, but it had been lost. All tangible evidence, he says, had been lost to history. But the order had been had in the past. And now here's an ancient document 200 years before Christ that tells about it. And Gaster says this. He says, that can't be the Christian sacrament, for there's not the slightest suggestion that the bread and wine were regarded as his flesh and blood, or that the consumption of them had any redemptive power. In other words, the doctrine of transubstantiation introduced in the 3rd and 4th century A.D. was not in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and therefore it could not be Christian in origin. Certainly, the doctrines of transubstantiation are not Christian either, as we find from other books that have been found. But here, Dr. Gaster points out something fascinating. The Book of Mormon sheds light on the possession of the Urim and Thummim. And anyone who possesses the Urim and Thummim is a seer. It's an emphatic doctrine of the Book of Mormon. Here's what Gaster says. The brethren of this community were especially enlightened. Moreover, the brethren sometimes describe this special illumination by the strange compound word or tom, literally light perfection. This was simply a play on the biblical Urim and Thummim of the high priest. So the brethren apparently claim they have the Urim and Thummim. There are many things that we can go into Dr. Schubert, an Austrian expert on the Dead Sea Scrolls, points out that we now know that the Aaronic priesthood is subservient to the Melchizedek priesthood in light of the Dead Sea Scrolls. In one of the Israel exploration journals, it says, healing through laying on of hands in a Dead Sea Scroll. Fascinating practice. Seems the Mormons were rather peculiar in their habits in that regard. In the same scroll, it says that they also ordained to priesthood by laying on of hands, in that same article. So the fascinating things go on. There's a list of material. I think I have copies for a family. You may all get a copy if you desire when you come up afterwards. And in order to make sure I cover the essentials, I'll run through this rather rapidly. Prayer, they sought for 20 years for revelation, and then they received it direct with a face-to-face confrontation. Now, among the Dead Sea Scrolls are fragments of the Book of Samuel and other documents that go back to 750 B.C. The interesting thing is they're calling now for a new Old Testament. Why? Because as much as 30% of some documents in the Old Testament have been removed. And the fascinating thing about the material removed, it deals with the nature and character of God as an anthropomorphic being, as an individual. The church was organized, and they called it Jihad, the same way as we would call it today, and as Luke called it in the book of Acts. And then they organized with a group of 12 who were true witnesses, and a council of three who were the ruling group of priests, and then they had a presiding bishop and bishops. And the whole Dead Sea Scrolls deal with the nature and character of the Trinity, God, the Messiah, and the Anointed One. Now, some of you may have seen the Interpreter's Bible, both Interpreter's Bible and the dictionary, and the commentary set in 12 volumes. In the one on Genesis at the back, Dr. Cross and some of the other experts who worked in the first teams in 1949 and 50 on the Dead Sea Scrolls say, we now understand the office and the mission of the Holy Ghost for the first time with clarity in the light of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And his office is to be a witness and a testator and not on his own authority. And then he goes on and has two whole pages on the subject, exactly as we have been teaching it for 130 years. And there was the sacrament of bread and wine, baptism by immersion for the remission of sins at the age of 8 or 9, after interview with the bishop, community order, and there were covenants. Tithing was paid to the son of Aaron or the bishop. There was a theology of history that dealt with such things as preexistence, which was not a Christian doctrine, but which now is being found in these ancient scrolls. Before they were born, he established all that designed them. And it goes on down here, and he created spirits of light and darkness. Upon them he founded every work, and then there was a spirit of darkness. That he was allotted a certain time to trip the sons of light, but the God of Israel and his angel of truth have helped all the sons of light. And it goes on and on. And then here's why I got interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls. I got a copy of this document, and this is it. It's all tattered and worn. I got brand new in it, but I'm fascinated with this because this is what introduced me to the Dead Sea Scrolls 25 years ago. This sentence is probably a clear enunciation of one of the most peculiar Mormon doctrines of all that we have. You see, but is not. If you abide the counsel of the Holy Ghost, you shall have healing and peace during length of days, and then bear children with all everlasting blessings and eternal rejoicing in the victorious life of eternity, and have a crown of glory together with garments of majesty, and dwell in eternal light. The whole comment and all the experts on that is that this would indicate the sect marriage. They have no concept of the significance. However, in some of their footnotes on the words and the semantics, they indicate such things as this. The primary meaning here is eternity. It carries a connotation of victory, as may be seen from its root meaning. And it goes on in here, says the same for crown is employed here, victory. And it goes on and talks about the garment, the nature of it, garments of glory. And then you dwell with God on an eternal height, in eternal light. In one of the other scrolls, Dr. Vermeer teaches there the same thing. He points out this. God chose them before the beginning of the world, and he knew their works, and he knew the years of their office, and the number and exact effects of their appointed times. Good Mormon theology, isn't it? And he knew from all eternity and forevermore that which would befall at the appointed time of years. And then he raised up for himself men called by name. In other documents, he says, I call them friends. Remember that in the Doctrine and Covenants, because that's what it says. And then he says, he called up men by name in order to leave survivors of the land and to people the face of the universe with their seed. And he made known his Holy Spirit unto them through his Anointed One. Really, really prime good Mormon doctrine there. And that was translated by a Catholic scholar. We don't even have to do much on it. It's all done. There are many other things, of course, but those are essentials. Laying on of hands and having eternal life, The idea of having eternal seed is one of the things we who are temple goers expect and want fulfilled. And yet we have never expressed it any clearer or more succinctly than you find in one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. How many have gone to the temple? Well, one of the scrolls says something like this. When I read that particular passage, I walked around, my hair standing on end and my skin tingling. The young man had woke up from a drunken stupor during the night, and he realized he was damned because during the night he had revealed the new name and the key word. In the scroll that talks about washings and baptisms, new names and key words. In fact, in the Nag Hammadi discoveries recently, being worked on now by Nibley and Kent Brown at BYU, and which are linked with the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that's where I'm doing my work right now, is on the Nag Hammadi material. You can reconstruct the entire temple ceremony from the scroll material and from the Nag Hammadi documents. There's 1,000 pages of material. Kent Brown was working with Dorese, one of the experts on the Nag Hammadi material. In fact, he's written some of the most important books. And all of a sudden, Kent was really going real fast, and Dorese asked him, "How come you're working so fast?" "Because it's ancient Coptic Egyptian material." Kent says, "It's quite familiar." And it was the difference. I talked to Nibley about 3 weeks ago tomorrow, and he's coming out with an 800-page book in about a month, and much of the material will be in there. In fact, when he started working on the Nag Hammadi material, when he went to the first faculty meeting, and this is in a document I have from him, he told the brethren, he said, "We'll have to adjourn to the temple to discuss what I've just been reading." And then he had a class a year ago, and you could only be a member of the class if you had a temple endowment, because when they got to a certain part of the text, they went to the temple, and that's where they studied it. And you can see again that it's tremendous. When the missionaries were bringing me down tonight, I told them some fascinating things that we just got working on the last 2 or 3 weeks. And it's tremendous. Time just probably won't permit to tell you everything on it. So washings, anointings, traditions of buried records, bearing the scrolls. The scrolls are full of angels and everything. Dr. Schoenfield, an expert on the Dead Sea Scrolls, here's what he finally concludes. He's a Jewish expert. "All these considerations and many more when we go over the records tell, in my opinion, of a gigantic effort of the most careful planning and preparation so that the elect of the period at the end of time would be primed with everything they would need. Everything would be in the books, nothing neglected, and all the books safely stored for their predestined purpose. It would appear that in the caves of the ruins of Qumran we have stumbled upon books designed for the faithful in the last great struggle with evil, books for the skilled to understand and not meant to be accessible before their time." Dr. Schoenfield did two amazing things. In the great Isaiah scroll, which is 27 feet long and about that high, this is Dr. Trevor's first picture, the whole picture. This was just published a year ago in book form by Dr. Trevor. I know him personally, and I have it in my kit over there, a whole half hour of his description of the discoveries and things like that, and his interpretation. And when you hear it, you can get beautiful Mormon doctrine from it, from what he said. But that scroll right there is fascinating because it's the book of Isaiah. It goes back to 200 B.C. And in that scroll material, all through the columns and the edges, I show in a couple of missionaries when I come down, there is material there that designates everything in Isaiah concerning the coming of the Messiah. Because Asaph, the member of this community who became the leader, was informed this was all for the preparation of the coming of the Messiah. And Schoenfield was able to read that because it was written in Hebrew, written backwards. And he was able to break the code. And every one of the designations concerning the Messiah are as we, as LDS people, teach it. Not as any Christian church. Among the 725 Christian churches, their expectation of the coming of the Messiah is devoid of validity based on these scrolls. But as we teach it, we are now confirmed in every instance. It's tremendous. Really fascinating. And also in this material, Dr. Schoenfield discovered some of the most amazing things concerning the legend of Ben Barakiah. The whole area here, the whole legend of Ben Barakiah, because he's a Jew. And only a Jewish individual who is thoroughly informed in certain aspects of the legendary material knows anything about the legend of Joseph Ben Barakiah, to whom Elijah will appear in the last days. The legend of this Ben Barakiah is fascinating, and we'll close with that as we get along. Now, in 1962, Dr. Yagiyadin, because the first Jewish general now had turned archaeologist and went and joined his father, and out in the Dead Sea area, south of the Judean desert, they split the area up into three sectors. And Gilead, being the junior archaeologist, because he had been a general first, he got the least attractive of the ground to work over. He was a little disappointed to start with, but there was something fortuitous about it all, something most amazing. And then in 1962, having discovered 15 beautiful documents in one of the caves, he came to the home of Ben Kiva, President Kiva, and Ben Gurion, first Prime Minister of Israel in 1900 years. And there was the practice of Ben Gurion to have the archaeologists to come and bring their latest exploration results once a month and bring him up to date on what was going on, because everybody over there are archaeologists. And so when his turn came, Dr. Gileadin flashed on the screen a document. And he turned to Ben Gurion and he said, "Your Excellency, I have the honor of showing you the signature of one of the 15 dispatches we have found of the last Prime Minister of Israel 1900 years ago." And he was showing it to the first Prime Minister of Israel 1900 years later. And it was the signature also of the last Jewish general of Israel 1900 years before. And Gideon, the first Jewish general 1900 years later, found it. In that same scroll was an amazing name. In the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith, according to the non-Mormons, fabricated many fascinating names. And he had some problems, perhaps. For example, he named a man Alma, with a female ending. And in one of the scrolls, Professor Yadin sensibly renders the name Alma, the son of Judah, Ben-Judah. And in one of the Dead Sea Scrolls that dates 150 years before the time of Christ, the name of Alma stands out prominently. The only place the name of Alma appears outside of the Book of Mormon. So how could Joseph Smith have conjured that up? But there's other things, too, that are fascinating as we find as we go along. Dr. Gideon Den was a consultant during the Six-Day War in 1967. Every time they had a war, of course, he was called on active duty again. This particular occasion, he had been following the Tamir tribe because they still had this delicate line. Tamir tribes find scrolls even after the experts got through hunting 280 cases. And then Kondo buys them and he deals with Antiquities Head. Antiquities Head is Professor Sade. Professor Sade then would go to Kondo and pick up the scroll material and then negotiate the price. Kondo represented that he had a beautiful scroll, the largest and the best that had ever been found. He wanted $1.5 million for it. During the Six-Day War, Yigiti didn't put him under 5-day house arrest and took him to Tel Aviv. At Tel Aviv, Kondo reflected apparently on his condition and circumstance, or whatever. But the next day after he was released, Yigiti didn't have this new scroll. It was the longest of the scrolls that had ever been found, 33 feet long. And then Yigiti didn't went to translate it. And I have this as a result of an interesting episode. When I was in the museum of the book, I went up to a table in the museum, and there was a young fellow selling a magazine called Israel. And open to this page was a picture of Gideon describing how he got that scroll. Because he hadn't been permitted to describe how he got it, how much he paid for it, or anything for 7 years because of this reason. When he first opened the scroll and began to read it, it dealt with the deployment of troops in the last days, and it was such an accurate description of the deployment during the 1967 Day War, the censors wouldn't let him publish the document for 7 years. And now it's coming out this summer. But in the major part of that document, it dealt with a temple that would be built in a place called New Jerusalem, with a high wall and 12 gates, and he gave a description of the temple, and it's found only in one other place, in the documentary history of the church over the signature of Joseph Smith. And in his material on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and in the temple document, he says there's a whole corpus of material dealing with a place called New Jerusalem. He says, we don't understand it. It describes a temple that's not like the temple that Ezekiel describes, because it's in the last chapters of Ezekiel, where the temple that'll be built in Old Jerusalem is described in detail, because Ezekiel was taken to that temple and was given a vision of it and measured out and described it in chapters 40 and 43. You go and read it there. And he says, that's not the temple. He says, we're mystified. Where's this temple? Where's New Jerusalem? Ask any more. You'll know. And so this temple scroll will be out. The contents of it, except for that brief description, have not been available. And it should be out sometime this summer. It'll be tremendous and quite interesting because of the things. So discoveries are going on. In fact, when I went to Israel and I gave two lectures on the Dead Sea Scrolls, the next morning I was at the Museum of the Book. On the second, I was studying that big Isaiah scroll. And one of the professors that heard me the night before called me down and introduced me to an Arab. He said, this is Mahim, who was actually in the cave. And he knows Kondo, and he can take you to this man Kondo. Oh boy, I wanted to meet Kondo. And he was an old man, of course. And so he said, meet me at the hotel at 4 o'clock. And at 4 o'clock, I was there at the hotel. And at 4 o'clock, he says, Kondo would come back to Bethlehem. He has a little shop with his brother in Jerusalem. He's quite a tired man. And maybe he'll come back at 5:30. But I said, well, where does he stay? Where does he come back to? And he pointed it out. And then he took some groups off to the waiting wall on a tour. And I went to this shop by the St. George Hotel in New Jerusalem and waited there for Kondo to return and met his brother. The first counselor in the branch presidency to fitness had told me the day before that if I ever wanted anything from the Arabs, the money always talks. And there was a beautiful Persian turquoise bracelet there, so I bought it for my wife. And just as I bought it, Condo comes in, and he gave me the change out of his own pocket. But I'm just an American tourist as far as he's concerned, and I'm busybodying around asking him about scrolls. And he didn't want to talk about anything, and he pretended he couldn't even understand English too much. I knew better, but I still couldn't get anywhere with him. His brother, because I had bought this, however, took me upstairs and showed me the two jars that had come from the first cave. And I had a picture. He took a picture of me standing by the jars. And then just then, he pointed over the balcony, and a man had walked in. He says, "Do you know that man?" Well, it was Professor Sade. I'd never met him. And he was, of course, one of the principal individuals responsible for the editing and the translation and the getting a team of 10 men to come every year to work on the scrolls for 20 years. And he took me down and introduced me to Professor Sade. Now I've met Professor Sade and Condo, and I knew Trevor. And Gilyadin, I have a tape of his voice describing his discoveries. Sukini, his father is dead. So I had nearly everything then in terms of the original men who had been surrounded with scrolls. But they weren't going to tell me anything, Professor Sade nor Condo. Now, then they offered me some coffee because I was persisting and they were getting tired of an American. And so they offered me some coffee to be generous. I said, "No, I'm a Mormon." And I don't know why I bluntly said it that way, and all of a sudden Professor Sade hit me on the back of the back, and he says, "I'm a half-Mormon." Bang! He says, "I'm a personal friend of President Mackay." And of course, I knew who that was. And then he went on to tell me. Then they both opened up, and for an hour and a half, I got enough to write a book. I got a lot of details. Professor Sade was the Arab to whom Hugh Nibley had gone secretly to negotiate for scroll material for BYU. Professor Sade was the one that President McKay had interviewed all one afternoon and taped it. And at the end of the interview, he had asked Professor Sade, "What happened to the people of the scroll? What happened to them?" Professor Sade said, "Well, the expert this and expert that." And President McKay said, "No, what do you think?" And Professor Sade said, "I think they joined the church." In the book of Acts, it says the priests joined the church. What priests? Those who had nailed Christ to the cross? Who were the priests? Professor Sade and others think it was this group in the community who had been preparing for the coming of the Messiah, and when he came, they were some of the original members of the Jewish community of Christianity in Jerusalem. So Professor Sade was given a chauffeur and a car at the church expense and went to BYU and taught for a semester and lectured on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and so he was a half Mormon because of that. But through him and through the church, there's been a great deal of work done with the Arabs. And because of that relationship, he gave me some cards so I could go through the Jordan line. And when I was there, they were working on the Golan Heights. I sat out on Galilee and watched the shell fire on the Golan Heights there on Mount Hermon one night. But I had a pass to go through the line, but I couldn't take a Jew with me, of course, on it because of what the Mormon Church was doing with the Arabs on the Jordan side. Tremendous experience of meeting Condo. And then Sade had Condo write his signature on a card. And then underneath it, Professor Sade wrote, "This is the signature of Kahil Condo." And then underneath, he wrote his. They're both elderly men. And then they took me upstairs, and now I saw why Sade was there. Condo had had some more scrolls. And I probably was one of the first white men to see a brown calf skin new scroll and one in papyrus. And oh, what an experience. And that's what Sade was probably doing there, to negotiate the purchase of two more scrolls. So it was a fascinating event. A real enriching experience. The doctrines of the scrolls were most fascinating. What happened was something like this. In the year 70 AD, the community had now dwindled to a very small number. Most of them had gone off and joined the Christian church. At least old books were written on that subject. In Jericho, there was a man by the name of Titus. Titus was the son of Vespasian, who had just taken over the whole Roman Empire. And his father had said, "Deal with the Jewish problem, because an insurrection had started." And in 134 days, Titus went to Jerusalem. That says I should be a little further along than that. Titus went to Jerusalem, and there in 134 days, he executed and killed 1,222,000 Jews. And in the same 134 days, in 529 towns, he killed another 900,000. And he took 100,000 young men on a forced march back to Rome, and only 10,000 arrived alive, and they were fed in the arenas. He reduced the total Jewish population to the immediate Judean area to 8,000 people in 134 days. And that population stayed static on just about that amount for 1,900 years until a man called Orson Hyde issued a small prayer on the Mount of Olives. And then things began to happen. But at the same time that the church was nearly restored, something horrible happened in Germany. In 1819, the Hamburg Proclamation was made. And in there, the Jews decided to assimilate with the people, and they actually decided to remove from their handbooks and all of their words every reference to the return to Jerusalem, and also a reference to the rebuilding of the temple, and themselves as an elect nation of God. And then in 1883, they issued the Pittsburgh Proclamation. This was done by the Polish Jews, and they enlisted the German Jews to assist them. This information is found in a book published last year by the Jews themselves. And in the 1883 proclamation, they then eliminated from all their prayer books and all of their various materials and everything, every reference to the return to Jerusalem, the building up of a state, the building of the temple, and themselves as a nation. They were going contrary to what had already been put in motion by the restoration in the last days of the Church of Jesus Christ and the prayer that had been issued on Mount Olives. As a consequence of the 6 million Jews who were killed by Hitler, 4 million, 3 of them were Polish Jews and 1 million were German Jews, of the people who had said, we are no longer going back, when already the Lord had said, the preparations for your going back has been made. So if you want to know why that happened among Jewish people, there was the answer. It was a fascinating thing that I was able to get that publication. And then when Hitler was finished with the Holocaust, the same Jewish groups then rewrote their manuals and said, we now elect to return to Jerusalem. We now subscribe to the call. And so the Holocaust was understood a little bit more in that vein. Dr. Tvetnis, who had told me about working it out with the Arabs and Galbraith, had some unique experiences. I should tell you this because it's one of the most important things that happened while we were in Jerusalem. They set up the new branch of the church in September of 1972 with Galbraith and Tvetnis and another man I never met as the counselors and the president of that branch. And one of the first things they were instructed to do by Harold B. Lee was to translate the testimony of Joseph Smith into Hebrew. And as they began their translating work, even though both of them were Hebrewists and taught the subject, they found difficulties in the Hebrew in trying to get it perfected and polished. And so they inquired around, and they kept running into the name of a man called Shinari, who was an expert in Hebrew. And when they finally met the man, they found that he was also an expert in Egyptian and Akkadian and Greek and archaic Hebrew and Mesopotamian and a few other things. And a very religious man. And so he knelt and prayed with them in order to polish the testimony of Joseph Smith. And it was finished in April, the day before I arrived. At the same time, they hoped to be able to involve him in the translation of the Book of Mormon, because Harold B. Lee also commissioned them to get the Book of Mormon translated into Hebrew. And so they approached Shinar, and he said it'd take 2 years. Now, something else had happened in the meantime. Just before President Joseph Fielding Smith had died, Ludlow and Nightinger of the Church Translating Committee, and they worked in 75 foreign languages, had heard that the Book of Mormon had been translated into Hebrew by a man called Miller, a Jewish convert of the church in the 20s. They tried to trace this down. Oddly enough, Ludlow was offered a copy of the first book of Nephi for sale. And so he bought it, took it to President Smith. President Smith took it from him and said, thank you for returning stolen property, put it in his desk and dismissed him. And there was no explanations or anything on it. And after his death, they went to Bruce McConkie, who was the executor of the estate of his father-in-law, and tried to get that, see if the rest of the translation was with it. McConkie told him no, that the safe in which it was contained had been willed to the first president of the church because of sacred things that were contained therein. So they went to Harold B. Lee, who had given them the commission, you see, to get it translated in Hebrew, and he gave them a letter to take back to Bruce McConkie, and when they opened it up, there was the entire Book of Mormon in Hebrew that had been done by Miller, and the seer stone, and a few other things that were fascinating. This explains why Joseph Fielding Smith kept telling everybody who wrote about the seer stone, the Urim and Thummim, and they were all wet when they considered certain of their conclusions about the seer stone, because he had it. Then they took the whole Book of Mormon in Hebrew in January to Jerusalem and gave it to Galbraith. And Galbraith took it to Shinari. And Shinari said, it's a very poor translation, but he said, it couldn't have been any better. In fact, for the time, it was probably the best. Because in 1893, a man called Ben Yehudi had begun to work on Hebrew to be used as a modern language. The Old Testament, you only need a vocabulary of about 1,000 words. And in the Book of Mormon, you'll need about 826 words. I mean, not in the Book of Mormon, but some of the other texts. As a consequence, Ben Yehudi began to work on a modern Hebrew text and dictionary and everything in opposition to the rabbis and everybody. And he devoted his entire life to it. But as a result now, modern Hebrew as a language is now stands as a most useful language. The last thing Ben-Yuri was working on was the nature and character of the body and the spirit united together as the soul. With the Ben-Yuri work completed just about a decade ago, you see, Miller in the 20s couldn't have really done a truly proper job of Hebrew translation, but he had started it. And so Shinari said, because he has done this, it'll cut my translating time to 6 months, and he would accept the job. So that was a marvelous thing. So on the day after I left, Nininger arrived to commission Shinari to do the translating work for the Book of Mormon, and they wanted it in Hebrew in 18 months. In the meantime, Galbraith had taken the prayer of Orson Hyde and put it in English and in Hebrew on a beautiful parchment. I got a copy of it, and I brought it back with me, but it's too big to travel around with. And then they decided they would go to the very important political figure who was the mayor of Jerusalem after the Six-Day War in 67 and high up in government circles, and see if they couldn't prevail with him to get some land for an information center of the church. And they took the scroll in with the Orson Hyde prayer on it and gave it to the mayor, and the mayor unrolled it and rolled it back up and gave it to him and said, I don't want this. I've got it memorized. We understand from Galbraith and others that there are Jewish people in high circles who are absolutely thoroughly informed of the nature and character of our movement, our sympathies about the Jews, our prophecies, and also concerning the Orson Hyde prayer, and you should read it. I often ask, how many have read the Orson Hyde prayer? How many have asked, Four or five among 200 or 300 of you. And yet, you see, there are Jewish people in high places who have it memorized. And he gave them as a personal gift land at the Java Gate for the Church Information Center. They didn't have to buy a thing. Tevetness had been commissioned to work on the phononymics of the Book of Mormon. And this was a problem. Because you see, there's anti-Mormons, apostate Mormons, who have written that there are 2,000 changes in the Book of Mormon. Tevetness worked on it carefully. He wrote him a letter. He said, no, there's not 2,000, there's 5,000 changes. So they'd correct their things. And then as he began to work on it, here's what he found. The present Book of Mormon today is difficult to translate into Hebrew, but the original document translated or written by Oliver Cowdery is beautiful. You see, in the original text, they say Joseph Smith was a poor this and a poor that, and the original Book of Mormon didn't have any punctuation, and it was poor English, and there was grammatical mistakes and everything. But the odd thing was that in ancient Hebrew, there's no grammar designations, and there's also no punctuation or anything. And Joseph Smith translated it from an uncorrupted text. And when Tibetans began to work in Shinari and Galbraith on the Hebrew original text of the Book of Mormon, they found every one of the 5,000 changes went back into perfect Hebrew. And he bore that witness at a special meeting in the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem. And it is startling, because even the names and the phononymics and everything, because in Hebrew you don't put any vowels in. Joseph Smith could have fouled up, because in the Book of Mormon you got hundreds of names. Some of them that are Egyptian and Mesopotamian, and they're Jewish in origin, just like the name Alma. And now we have absolute proof that he did it phonetically right. And so all of these names and everything were all phonetically worked out. Then he found some interesting things. When he got to the Book of Jaredite, he found that Moroni had tampered with the text. Moroni, as he began to translate the ancient text that Mosiah had translated from the Jaredite records and made an abridgment of it, he would come to a hill. And Moroni would say, well, that hill's called Cumorah. But the Jaredites called it Shem. But he would change the name to Cumorah. And every river and every hill that he knew, he changed the name to a Nephite name. Then he ran on to some names he didn't know, and some rivers he didn't know, and some hills he didn't know. And he left the correct names in there, and they're Mesopotamian. How could Joseph Smith have made the distinction? Because some of the Mesopotamian languages haven't been actually translated, some of them not even yet today. And yet Joseph Smith, in making his additions there in the names in the hills, correctly preserved what Moroni had translated in his abridgment. And so the witness there is tremendous. I told you about Arad, that little thing at Arad. In the Book of Mormon, it tells about how Moses went off into that Alma went into the wilderness and was translated like Moses. The Book of Mormon teaches us that Moses was a translated being. There's one whole scroll that deals with the translation of Moses. There's another scroll that deals with the information given to Abraham found in only one other book in existence. It's called the Prograde Christ, dealing with instructions the Lord personally gave Abraham. It's been written up in the Church New by Presnell Robinson, so I need not repeat it here tonight. You can find that material in his books that he published. He published two on the subject. But at Arad, they just did some excavating in the last couple of years. It's a little desert area way out on the Dead Sea. And there they found all the necessary altars and everything for temple ordinances. And the Jewish people were stunned by it, because the temple was supposed to have been built by Solomon. you see, after the time of David. The true temple, the great temple, was the Temple of Solomon. What was a temple like their temple doing down in the southern part of the desert? And it was astonishing because in some places that little place goes back to 800 years before the Temple of Solomon was built. And it's been a startling revelation to the Jewish people. And it's being discussed and studied by Tibetans and others. It'll appear in some publications at BYU here shortly. But there at Arad, they have evidence of this thing. And yet, you see, in the 107th section of Doctrine and Covenants, it says, and Jethro received his priesthood back through a line going to a man called Isaiah at the time of Abraham. And Jethro laid hands upon Moses and gave him the priesthood and the ordinances and everything he received. And who was it that guided Moses up into the northern territories? Jethro's son. And Jethro's son had the priesthood and all these things. And who was it that built Arad? Jethro's son, 1,800 years. And so you see, the Midianites had the priesthood. And in the doctrinal commentary by McConkie, he points out that the Midianites, who were descendants of the fourth son of Keturah, Abraham's third wife, had preserved constantly the whole doctrine of the Messiah, the temple endowments, and everything, even down to the time Christ was born. And in your new course in the Gospel Doctrine, you're going to read about that coming up, so we can leave that out. The Dead Sea Scrolls, the tales of an individual who would come forth before the coming of the Messiah. He'd be Ben Berechiah. And this legend is among the Jews. He'd be a descendant of Ephraim. He'd be a restorer of priesthood. He'd be filled with the Holy Ghost from the days of his youth. And there's 13 different documents in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and among others, that tell about this individual. And then how he would return God's favor to the Jewish people and gather up the elect from all the nations and bring them together and restore all that which had been had before, including the priesthood, and lead all these things, bring them together. And then he'd be killed by lawless men. His blood would cry for vengeance from the ground, and it'd be killed with another on the eve of the destruction of Jerusalem. These legends were all applied to this man, Asaph. And these legends all applied to that leader, because he was the son of a man called Asaph. Except that Asaph died of old age. And so the documents become obscured and banished into obscurity after the second century. All the scrolls say that the man Ben Berechiah, who would come in the last days, his name would be Joseph. The Dead Sea Scrolls explicitly state that a man called Joseph would come in the last days and do all those things and then be killed. The man Asaph, that's what the Hebrew word for Joseph is, Joseph. And he was the son of the man called Joseph. And so they thought he was the man because he was preparing for the coming of the Messiah. And when he died of old age, they knew he was not the man, but rather instead of Ben Berechiah, Joseph would come at another time. It's our witness that that man Joseph was Joseph Smith. And those who study the documents now will find it amazing, tremendous things. You have my testimony, of course. You can see it all through what we've talked to you tonight. It's a testimony, of course, that comes from this kind of research and everything, but also from a conviction that comes from other things because of the experiences associated with these. You'll be given no more brownie points for believing on faith alone, because every intimate doctrine of this church now resides in documents found in the last 20 years. 20 major discoveries have been made in here, in Mesoamerica, Central America, in Egypt, and in Judah, and elsewhere, that confirm everything we've ever uniquely taught. On the 24th page of the Book of Mormon, it says that's exactly what will happen before the Christ comes. The Gentiles will make the discoveries, they'll prove the Bible, prove the Book of Mormon, prove other things, but we think that the great discoveries are yet to come. And the new translation material and Nag Hammadi and materials will really confirm it. Doctrines about our Heavenly Mother, the nature and character of our Father, the nature and character of God's existence and preexistence are all found in these scrolls, as we've uniquely taught it for 130 years. So I leave you my testimony, and may you get the testimony and keep it in Christ's name, amen. Now, for a few minutes, I could entertain a few questions, if you'd like. Yes, in a priesthood manual by Nibley, written back in 1957, the leading expert on the Dead Sea Scrolls is a man called Molin. He's an Austrian Catholic. In chapter 15, Dr. Nibley gives all the things that Molin describes concerning the Christian churches and things like that, and then Molin says this. He says, the whole way of life of this ancient sect appears constantly in the light of the last days. Latter-day Saints, a certain Christian sect of our time call themselves, one can correctly attribute this title to the sect we're dealing with here. And Nibley goes on and points out, the last remark by Molin is indeed a significant concession, the more so since it's given grudgingly, and he knows Molin. And Molin says, you might as well call the people of Qumran Mormons and be done with it. That's right. There are some who really know it. I mean, really scholars. In 1964, the Catholics have come out with a series of encyclicals. Have you been following those? They're going back now to priesthood and revelation and restoration and preexistence and things like that. Because you see, they have to harmonize with what's being found about the first century. And the first century documents now being found clearly show something happened in the third and fourth century that distorted totally Christian doctrine. And that new conformity, if you want to read about it, Nibley quotes it in his book called Sense Camorra extensively. So you can get that comparison. Yes. This one by Gaster, because he points clearly out the Catholic position, and our position then very much so. It has much of the Dead Sea material that's available, including the one I've been talking and quoting from. The Dead Sea Scriptures by Dr. Gaster. It's available in paperback. I just bought 60 copies from my class this fall, and it's only $2.98. It's one of the best. There are others, of course. Dr. Nibley in his book Sense Camorra is a very essential book to have on the Dead Sea Scrolls, because he compares many, many pages there to the Book of Mormon material. There's also several books that have been published by Personal Robinson, two of them. How Old is Christ's Gospel? And the Origins of Christianity. And then here he makes many, many comparisons that are tremendously fascinating. Some of the scrolls even talk about the fact that Adam came to Jordan and he entered into the water and he plunged himself altogether with the flood, even to the hairs of his head, while he made supplication to God. Another place it tells that Christ will be baptizing Jordan, and they said that's Christian. But they found it one of the scrolls that had been deposited the year 35 B.C. So you got problems. Yes? All right. I don't know whether time will permit. Skousen has done quite a bit of lecturing, and some of you may have heard his talk. And in his talk, he tells about Klausner, a Jewish writer who has done a great deal of research concerning the Jewish legend of the forerunner to come. His name will be Joseph, Ben Barakiah Joseph. So this forerunner, who will come in the last days or before the Messiah, and he's almost considered messianic in character, but not the Messiah, the forerunner. He only had two references or three references in Klausner. At the lecture he gave one time in Las Vegas, my son went up to him afterwards and said, aren't you familiar with the 13 other references in the Dead Sea Scrolls? So he called me on the phone that night, and we exchanged some information. In the meantime, I didn't know about his reference. And so when I heard his reference, I went back to my library and I said, I got to have that book somewhere, because immediately in my mind flashed Blue Book. And I went through my entire library and I couldn't find Klausner's book on the reference. But as I began to ponder upon it and everything and do some research, it kept coming back to me that there was a Blue Book in my library. Now, some of the missionaries that are here have seen my library. It's wall-to-wall books in a quite a large room. And finally, I went up to this one book, and I got sensitized every time I got close to it, and so I pulled it off the wall. He That Cometh, by Mawinkel, a Jewish expert in Sweden. And here in this book, as I began to read it, was page after page concerning the Ben Barakiah Joseph who would come, his birthright, his name would be Joseph, and there was information concerning the blessings that ancient Joseph received. And here's a passage. As Jacob, before he died, laid his right hand on Joseph's youngest son, and thus gave him the birthright and the greater blessing, so the book of Jubilees, the Dead Sea Scroll, tells us that the dying Isaac blessed Levi and Judah, but gave the birthright to Levi, and then he goes on, and so on. Then he continues on and tells about how this will be the forerunner. He'll be approached by Elijah. He says the expression, Messiah ben David, is used, for example, to distinguish him from the Messiah ben Joseph, so that you got the Messiah, the Christ, and the Messiah ben Joseph. And about here, how the new day will arise eventually, and there will be the Messiahs from Mary and Israel, and this will be then will come the great Messiah who will be the Redeemer and the Comforter and the Chosen One of God. But this Ben Barakiah, while he's a messianic figure, he said, is the forerunner of the Messiah. And then he goes on and tells all this through here, through the whole book, and there I have the whole thing. Sitting there in my library and didn't even know about it. Then when I got to studying the scrolls and the work done by Schoenfield, he brought the whole thing together. There was among the Jews this total legend that there was a forerunner called Joseph who had come in the last days before the Messiah came. And then with the Dead Sea Scroll information now, the confirmation is there quite clearly. So I was fascinated. So I sent, I copied the first page of the book and everything so that Skousen could get a copy of it, because it was very interesting, very thorough. If you ask a good, knowledgeable, informed Jewish people, person, he'll know about the Ben Barakiah Joseph, or the forerunner to come, called Joseph. There are a number of Jewish people who have been converted to the church as a result of seeing this information and this knowledge. By the way, on the back of this sheet is Tevetness's work. Here he compares the organization of the church at the time of Moses, the time of Peter, James, and John, our church, and the organization under the Dead Sea Scrolls, and you'll find every one of the major things parallel. Exactly. Yes. That's the one I read to you about. They will be sealed up for eternity to bear children, fill the universe with their seed, and have children with garments of glory, and et cetera, and et cetera. The whole thing there has to... To emphasize it, the next paragraph is maybe really the shocker to give it to you, because it's the one that turned me on back 25 years ago. Recall 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. And these are they who do not abide the covenant, the new and everlasting covenant. These are they who do not abide the covenant, the multitude of plagues, angels of affliction, eternal ruin, furious anger of God, everlasting terror, perpetual disgrace, shame and destruction, bitter misfortune, because they can have no children. That's better than we say. So if you recall, Dr. Tibetanus is doing work now on the 88th section, the olive leaf section of the Doctrine and Covenants. There are things in this scroll here, the Seric scroll, that he is now working on, which will be published in about a year. And he says the author of the Seric scroll and the author of the 88th section of the Doctrine and Covenants are the same. And when his work comes out, you can refer to that, because the doctrines of covenants and light and expectations and everything are all contained therein. Yes. Yes, there's a number. This is going to be some of what Nibley is going to be bringing out. In fact, in the Book of Mormon, we have this amazing statement that we know what happened when Jesus Christ was resurrected. We know where he went and what he did, and that what he taught the 40 days when he came back. And anyone who's got the audacity to put in print what Christ did and taught and said and everything during that 40 days has got to be confronted with the possibility of documentary evidence being found. And that's what is being found. In the Nag Hammadi material, it tells about everything from the sacrament right down to the fact that Jesus Christ took the apostles down to the Sea of Galilee, and there he gave them new names and key words and ordinances and garments and et cetera, et cetera. And there they are in the scroll. And like I was telling the... one of the boys when I was coming down, I might as well pass that on to you then, since we got that far. Hugh Nibley was taken to task by one of the non-Mormons. And they said, Nibley, you're not translating this text correctly. Nibley had already gone on record in a BYU publication that it was a temple ceremony being dealt with. And Nibley said that in his translation, ancient messengers appeared to messengers of the Lord appeared to the ancient patriarch. And the non-Mormon said, no, Nibley, it should read, ancient apostles of the Lord appeared to ancient patriarchs, and that's a ridiculous translation. And Nibley says, case closed. And if you've been to the temple, you know what that means. And if you haven't, you don't know what it means. I hope you'll go to the temple. Why not? Because that's the nature of the text. And you can see how the Lord has provided keys and clues to the informed Latter-day Saint, the temple-going Latter-day Saint, to understand what's going on. So the... ordinances and prayers and things that we understand are quite unique. One of the Nag Hammadi discoveries state that Christ was married to Mary. And this will come out in the translations. It tells about priesthood, the royal line of priesthood, becoming gods, dwelling with God on an everlasting height, things like that. Fascinating. Whoever taught stuff like that? Mormons. Yes. The scrolls are in seven different languages, so no one man can read all of the material. In the first 4 caves, in 20 years, it has taken to reduce those all to modern Hebrew, French, and German. The men who go there work in teams. As many as 9 men were worked up by Professor Sade to work for a year or 2 years translating the scrolls. The Tumer tribe would bring in some of the documents in fragmental form because a piece the size of your little fingernail was worth $5. And they had to finally get them to quit breaking up the scrolls and bring in big ones and pay them more for them. They paid them $5 for every square centimeter of inscribed surface, so they get more money. They build a whole city with the money that they've got from the scrolls. They keep finding more and more material, even though the archaeologists keep going out trying to find the cave themselves. The Tumer tribe keep finding more material. So these languages and experts are required in order to reduce it to a common language, English or French. 7 languages, ancient Syriac, Phoenician, archaic Hebrew, Greek. In Cave 7 last year, there's a controversy that's raging right now that you just wouldn't believe, because in Cave 7 they found evidences of the letters of Paul, Titus, and Timothy, which deals with the office of the bishop, and fragments of the Gospel of Mark, and they date 55 A.D. In fact, here's what is being done. It is easier to surmise that the new discoveries will revolutionize intertestamental studies, that it will soon antiquate all present handbooks on the background of the New Testament and on the textual criticism and interpretation of the Old Testament, because what's being found. This means that everyone who ever wrote about the New Testament that the authors were not Mark, Luke, and John, or that it was written in the 2nd century A.D., or that the letters of Paul weren't circulated until after his death in 64 A.D., all those books are wrong. Because in Cave 7, there's fragments, you see, that date 55 A.D. before the destruction by Titus, because Titus came down to this area, killed everyone there, and erected a Roman fort for 135 years on the remains of the ruins of Qumran, and killed all the priests. And one of the priests ran by a cave as fast as he could go, and he hurled a document in the cave. It was an 8-foot-long scroll of brass. Ancients wrote on brass? Whoever taught such a thing as that? And it was the temple inventory that they had brought with them 200 years before Christ, with millions in gold and bullion. But he kept one more 4-foot section that says where it was. He left the inventory, but he took the key to where it was. And we don't know where it is. Yes. In fact, one of the first documents found in the Nag Hammadi materials was something like this. Early in the morning, two young men, not angels with wings, two young men come down and roll a stone aside and go into the cave, into the tomb, and they come out supporting the Christ. And a voice from heaven says, have you taught the spirits that sleep? And Christ says, yes, I have. And then it goes on. And you know, only the vision given to Joseph F. Smith in 1918, a few months before his death, gives the details found in that document. Like I say, it takes a semester to give you all of it. And that's why I've let you... That's why I've let you ask some questions, just so you can bring out a few more things. When you live with this day by day. Yes?
Is there anything that you're aware of that's
not
material?
No. Well, yes, my son keeps bringing up one thing. He says that we're so happy that they don't do like they did in those days, because if you fell asleep in church, they excommunicated you. So there might be a problem of penalty. But when you deal with the details in there, there's things on the branch that went over the wall, the nature and character of rock as being revelation, and all these various things. And so there's no problem. There's no negative areas in which we find a confrontation except in the form of penalties for what they did. If you didn't show up, if you missed a couple of meetings, you didn't have to come anymore. So this is a problem area. Yes. Yes, the only church that's getting the most mileage out of this Southern LDS people is the Humanitarian Church, which believe, of course, that Christ was just a teacher, and therefore they're getting a great deal of mileage. They have their own books. Dr. Potter has written some very fine ones, because now they can say, see, there's nothing really original in Christianity. It was all there 200 years before Christ. The council and the quorum and the sacraments and the whole works and everything that was uniquely Christian was really there already. And so they're getting the most mileage. But the other Christian churches are not coping with the problem. Their people aren't informed about it because of the nature of the controversy. We're not teaching, or they're not teaching in other Christian churches, anything alike what was taught in the first century. See? And so, I'll tell you the problem. Before you came in this room, how many of you had ever heard about the Dead Sea Scrolls and read on the Dead Sea Scrolls, anything in depth? How many of you? About two handful. The problem is worse than that in other churches. Because in the Ensign, in the Ensign and the New Era, every other month Nibley has had material on the Dead Sea Scrolls and Nag Hammadi material, so why aren't you reading them? See, that indicates to me you're not reading the church magazine. And that hurts me. You see? Also, in the church news, Preston O. Robinson dealt with the nature and character of the Genesis Apocryphon, that dealt with the translation of Enoch, and the instructions given to Abraham found only in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that means you're not reading your church news. See, you're revealing something here to me, and it's terrible. It leads you to apply the seat of the pants and see the chair getting informed. You've got to really be aware of what's going on today. In the 84th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, we're informed that we're supposed to read all things, all books of the uplift of mankind. And in that 24th page of the Book of Mormon, it says, the Gentiles will make the discoveries, they will translate, and it will prove all things. Now, you want to be aware of what is happening, because it's a tremendous movement. Tremendous material. And we've only got four caves translated. Wait until the next seven major caves are translated. And wait until 1,000 pages of the Nag Hammadi material is out. And then wait until the material at Telamarna and the Lachish and others. I worked on that problem and got all kinds of information which BYU published dealing with the nature and character of the first two pages of the Book of Mormon. So it's fascinating. I think time is gone, and I thank you for your attention, and I think you all know what your responsibilities are now. Among other things, get a testimony of the Church of Jesus Christ, of course, but mainly is to really realize deep down in your heart, and it may come as a shock to most people, this gospel is true.
This is the end of the talk given by Brother Erickson in the 22nd Ward of the Phoenix North Stake in August of 1974.